This is audiobook for personal listening, made of parts, extracts of book of Eduardo Pons Prydz, translated via Google, translated title is, 7 Hours on Board an Extraterrestrial Spaceship, from 1982, here may be word mistakes. Link, audio, search inside this folder, https://rune.galactic.to/leadbooker/2022/. Book seems to be out of print in 2024. Here then Google translated from Spanish to English. Remark, this has been found in Spanish language online, and translated here via Google into English, for personal use, and mistakes can certainly be found here, both in the translations, and in Google's perception, interpretation of the language otherwise. At some point in time, these messages will hopefully be shared by the coming cosmic, open, lovely society arriving after the upcoming collapse of the present animalistic, ego-focused world of today has gone. Introduction. This introduction, dear reader, cannot be a normal introduction, because the subject that we are going to address together in these pages is, to put it in the words of my good friend Antonio Ribera, one of the most important that the man of the 20th century has to face. For, just as we often say that Catalonia's problems cannot be solved except by focusing on and linking them to those of the rest of the Iberian communities and, by extension, that Europe's regional problems will not have a fair solution unless Europeans form a united band, with that peaceful desire par excellence that is to balance and moderate the confrontation between the two great superpowers and, on a planetary level, know how to radiate desires and hopes that are common to the human race. In the same way, perhaps the time has come to seriously consider whether the problems of the Earth, the danger of nuclear war, which prevents us from enjoying life to the full, hunger, which kills 50 million human beings every year, a third of whom are under 5 years old, are not going to have to be approached on a cosmic scale. And to do so, naturally, one of the first measures to be taken is to disqualify so many charlatans and freeloaders who swarm around, and to support, by collaborating with them, those who take, and have always taken, all human affairs very seriously. Hence, so that the little or great influence that these pages may have on the friendly reader is fully positive, one has thought it appropriate to surround his experience with a series of texts that show that, before his encounter with them, the author had already met men and women from Earth with a cosmic vision of existence, who possessed the humanity and intelligence of extraterrestrials, before they burst into our lives. About manipulation. My parents were libertarians, which means that, from a very young age, my two brothers, my sister and I were already taught to live freely. As freely as possible, in a world that is increasingly violent, aggressive and castrating. First, in our home, where my father never hit or punished anyone, preferring to explain, talk, reason, ad nauseam, about the small problems that could arise in our lives. Not so much at home as at school or on the street. At the same time, we were awakened to a sense of responsibility and criticism. I will speak in particular about my upbringing. I am the eldest of four siblings, and my education. My father not only did not punish his children by word or deed, but also the many apprentices he had at his side. And this was when he was a young worker in his native Valencia. His emigration to Barcelona in 1915 was due to an incident with the manager of a toy factory where my father worked. He had told the manager that if he had something against his apprentice, he should tell him. But it happened that one day, when my father was away, the foreman beat up the apprentice, a very common thing in those days and for many years five, and when he was asked to account for it, the henchman of the factory owner threatened my father. Never do that. A fellow worker in the workshop, the cabinet maker Cervera, told me what happened. The foreman gave him a bad end, Eduardo. A very bad end, because your father, as soon as he heard the threat, turned around and gave him a punch to die for. Don Santiago, the foreman, fell to the ground and did nothing but get up, and your father gave him another punch. And so on until several workers intervened and took the foreman to be treated in the medicine cabinet. What a beating he gave him. I had never seen your father so out of his mind, to be honest. He, who was a peaceful man, of infinite patience, that day seemed like a beast striking out. You cannot know what it meant in those days for a worker, even if he was right, like your father, to beat up a manager. A6. Yes, I did, because our mother had explained it to us. My father was put on the blacklist of the Valencian Woodworkers at EM Association. It was what was known as the A Hunger Pact. It was one of the many A inventions of the employers, A Spanish and non-Spanish, A to try to subdue the irreducible. And, like so many others, he had to emigrate and reach the A promised land, A which was Barcelona. That perhaps explains, because my father was not, by far, the only Valencian cabinet maker subject to the pact. It is worth mentioning this point first of all: none of us smokes, or drinks, or is fond of gambling, or has ever slept with a prostitute, or violated private property, at least not directly and personally, and has always lived off the fruits of his own labor, never off the labor of others. I mention all this because these particularities must have had some influence, one thinks, when it came to being chosen by the aliens as their messenger. What is more, no toy that had any relation to violence ever entered our house, nor did we ever see any books that incited or encouraged it in our parents' modest library. Nor any publication that awakened the base instincts that, as is known, each of us stores in greater or lesser quantities in our entrails. The same was true of the films we watched. Our parents never forbade us anything. They explained to us the inconveniences, discomforts and dangers that some inclinations could bring us. And it was we who had to decide, from a very young age, I repeat, what we would or would not do. Hence my lack of interest in gangster, western or horror films and my great passion for musical comedies and comedy films when I was a child. Consequently, we had no interest in weapons, nor the slightest inclination to coerce or violate anyone. Although this does not mean that one gave up airing children's street disputes with blows or clean stones, from time to time. That is, when persuasive resources failed, because I perfectly remember that, at times, the verbal warnings given by me were cancelled as soon as I heard someone say, "You are afraid of fighting." Until we reached July 1936, when, with a military uprising as a starting point, I was able to see that, in such circumstances, most of what my parents had taught me was of no use to me. And that to defend my freedom and my dignity, and those of my people, of course, the saviors of the fatherland, left me no other path than that of arms, nor any other desire than to try to eliminate my enemy before he eliminated me. So not only did I have to jump into the Iberian ring to kill, but, being a newly minted high school graduate, I joined a training and command school of the Republican Army, in Escorial de la Sierra, at the foot of the Guadarrama, from where I graduated with the rank of Sergeant Instructor of Accompanying Machines. Which meant that not only did I have to learn to kill myself, but I also had to teach other boys to kill. So, I ask myself, if my parents prepared me to live in a future world, the one dreamed of by them and so many of their companions, fraternal and free, knowing very well, because they were suffering it in their own flesh, every day, as workers' fighters, that for that we had to change the world in which we lived, because it was inspired by the lowest passions of man. Could it be said, I repeat, that I was manipulated by my parents? And even more, if that manipulation was oriented in the purest sense, could it be described as pejorative? I think, therefore, that the crew of that spaceship would have manipulated me, in the bad sense of the word, if they had insisted on making me see white as black, although it is true that they showed me colors that I had never seen, and claiming that it was day when it was night. Or that, suddenly, a galactic high priest or a charming priestess appeared, dictating orders coming, for example, from the Supreme Cosmic Order, and with no other alternative than unconditional compliance and irrational resignation. For now, I have no news of the existence of galactic dogmas of any kind, or of cases in which any of those who have had contact with them have exclaimed, "Here are our saviors," or that they have built a miniature flying saucer, with their crew inside, like a Holy Communion, or images of their extraterrestrial interlocutors, which they have placed on an altar, surrounded by lit candles and votive lamps, and that they are periodically venerated. Or, what would be much worse, that they did what priests or witches have done, it doesn't matter. In our latitudes, since time immemorial, which is to force others to venerate symbols or reproductions of gods or virgins, of apostles or martyrs, etc. And to me, mind you, this is the last thing that would occur to me, to give my testimony the slightest religious, evangelical or mystical touch, or a premonition of apocalyptic catastrophes or of paradisiacal beatitudes of a supernatural nature. I still believe, as before and as always, it is the man and woman of the earth who must set out on their own. The path has been known since ancient times, it is that of peace and fraternity, resolutely, towards a more dignified and free life. Although sometimes, we have to repeat it until it sinks deep into our consciences, that peace and fraternity must be won by fighting tooth and nail. However, the opposite has happened. They are the extraterrestrials. They know perfectly well that, given the idea of interfering in our affairs, manipulating us, who would set the limits of that interference? On the other hand, that corresponds to a behavior, to an attitude that is presumably centuries old in them, that of not interfering in other people's lives, and I do not believe that they would break that noble tradition for anything, or only in case of legitimate defense. But, as you will see, none of the topics we discussed during our long conversation, punctuated by long silences, presented anything very new to me. The only novelty was, perhaps, that they were so well focused, since one's mind never rested until clear, conclusive and unquestionable conclusions had been drawn. So much so that, during the course of the conversation, I asked myself the same question several times, but how come I hadn't thought of this before? So, if manipulation, apparently so feared by some, served to round out the analysis of each of our problems more quickly and to stop, once and for all, turning the wheel of the leaky buckets any further, I would have no other option than to shout, "Welcome, then, manipulation." On the other hand, ear to the footsteps, comrades. If one has any information about the odious and pernicious manipulation of which the vast majority of earthlings are victims by the tiny minority, for the exclusive benefit of the power and privileges of the latter, who has the moral authority, on this terrestrial globe of our happiness and misfortunes, to accuse anyone of manipulations, brainwashing, or other actions of such a nature. 7. They told me several times that they left it to my free will when, in what form, and under what conditions I could spread the message, as well as my impressions, with which, naturally, I intended to support it. I imagine that, if I had been so suggested by them or manipulated, it makes no difference, as soon as the message had been transcribed in my mind, I could have appeared in any sensationalist magazine in Europe, which, as is well known, there are in abundance here, and that would be it. I mean, I didn't have to worry too much about it. But instead of acting in such a way, trivializing the subject as so many others do, I started typing, at the rate of 2 to 3 hours a day, transcribing memories and reflections, and I devoted 6 or 7 hours a day to reading books and magazines dealing with UFOs, published in France, Spain and Italy. Exactly 4 months after my encounter with them, I decided to stop reading because I already had clear the true motives of so much expectation, the scientific one in particular, and so much speculation, and I decided to give all my notes in person, close to 2,000 pages, the form of a book. Because for me, a historian who investigates on the ground, who never leaves the arena, the book continues to be the most worthy vehicle that exists to communicate with others. But I must say that, if I had judged it useful, I would have spent weeks or months reading the specialists, especially if I had delved into UFO literature from American or Soviet sources, and I did read something from both sources, as you will see. I must confess, once again, that from what I have read, and not only about UFOs, but also with reference to some classical and modern thinkers, I have come to the conclusion that much of what is known as human scholarship is above all a mass of speculations, some more ambiguous than others, whose main disguise is the rounded phrase, which almost always, it must be admitted, sounds very good. That is why these thinkers have had no great difficulty in crossing the barrier of time, often cutting in flower other fruits of the human intellect that contain genuine truths, much more worthy of attention and study. In a word, it does not take much insight to see the common goal of so many scholar talkers, the complexing and the constriction of the vast majority, since how would the chosen ones stand out, if there were not an amorphous and uneducated mass, and, at the same levels, to overwhelm their colleagues with learned texts and masterful communications, they feed and encourage the speculative struggles to which they regularly engage, with as little discretion as they are unstoppable pride and insolence. That is to say, if it were possible to establish the great list, the planetaria of the A personality sir whose passage through life and their only incentive is nothing more than a simple A covering up the recorder and cultivating their insatiable egocentrism which they magnify and elevate to the category of A sublime discourse, A shamelessly and repeatedly, then it is very possible that we would begin to see more clearly and understand the true reasons for this constant drifting of this ship called Earth. And by chance, and by extension, the origin of all the frightful rackets that have been mounted around the subject of extraterrestrials and A's countless, mysterious and alarming extensions. A and, consequently, to see who our main manipulators are and what resources they use to falsify, adulterate and sterilize the incomparable power of popular creativity of the common people, of the vast majority of which, in my opinion, is the primary cause of our incessant misery. I will also say that many specialists whom I will not name, so as not to give them publicity, who, apparently, travel from one end of the world to the other periodically to enlighten us about our extraterrestrial past, could write their books, calmly, without leaving their home and just by reading and rereading, among others, H. G. Wells, Jules Verne or Edgar Allan Poe. Notice to Navigators. For some time now I have read tremendously insane things about the UFO phenomenon. Let me explain. I have been perplexed, and deeply alarmed, before an endless rosary of ramblings and speculations, about the human mind, that produce shivers and even nausea. And not so much because of the predictions and conclusions that the specialists spread in their learned works, but because of the growing influence, which I consider dangerously harmful, in the sense of making people believe, of instilling in people that the human mind can distill the most abject monstrosities imaginable, that is, being able to imagine many just by sticking to those we have witnessed in this last half century. But the mind is like consciousness. If it extends more and more intensely over human sensitivity every day, it is clear that, at the same pace, the space abandoned to unconsciousness is being reduced. And to be able to reach that stage that one imagines wonderful, that in which the scarce unconsciousness would act, if it could do so, in full consciousness. The mind, as is known, is something very little known and often poorly used. That is why the phrase "it has a convoluted mind" is something that is heard more and more frequently every day. Why? Simply because the AOE environment does not allow for more. If I am guided by my own experience and that of other people with a similar background to mine, apart, in any case, from religious influences, one believes that all this is a question of family and social environment. With this AU awning I intend to get ahead of that gang of charlatan specialists who, as my editor warned me, are going to come upon us like real birds of prey. And by giving them news of what my a mental evolution may have been roughly speaking throughout that half century I spoke of earlier, I am providing them with material to whet their appetites. And see, if they still have the capacity to look and see without blinkers and without those pseudo-scientific filters that they have invented, human things terrestrial and extraterrestrial with wide open and clear eyes, with clear understanding, with an expanded heart and with the most generous disposition that they can display. I know it's a lot to ask, but I don't want to leave it at that. I said I was almost ready to write this chapter before sending the outline of the book to my editor, and if it didn't figure in the initial project, it's because I never had the slightest inclination to be considered a provocateur. But these days, at the end of 1981, a work entitled Notes on the UFO Theme fell into my hands, whose introduction reads as follows. In the same way that the phenomenon adapts to the ideas of the time and place in which it occurs, the same occurs with the messages, which adapt to the personality of the person or group to whom they are addressed. The wording of the chapters and some of the captions are also a poem. Let's read the first ones. 1. It is not a purely physical phenomenon. 2. It is not a purely psychic phenomenon. 3. Its origin is not at all clear. 4. There is some kind of intelligence, a hidden and sinister plan, behind the phenomenon. 5. It is not clear whether they are benevolent towards us. 6. If we consider the phenomenon, relating the different types of contact that history presents, we observe two kinds of situations, forming two groups, one with fixed characteristics and the other with variable characteristics. And in the captions we read, are UFOs mere mental creations of those contacted? Imaginary phenomena created by fantasy? Unusual events, transformed into tangible by the mind, in a paranormal way? Or real events? Coming from an external intelligence, capable of influencing the human psyche? Or, perhaps it is in the depths of our mind where we must look for the nature of the phenomenon that we know today as the UFO? Perhaps, as some researchers claim and others insinuate, some kind of intelligence, perhaps identifiable with deep levels of our own unconscious, is capable of projecting itself, using the faculties with which the mind is endowed, outside of our physical being, to elaborate a kind of psychodrama, destined to modify our consciences. 9. The truth is that any contactee who reads this, or other things of a similar nature, must necessarily exclaim, "Wow, I didn't think I was so deteriorated internally." When it would be much easier and more humane to let each person explain his or her experiences, however strange they may seem to some and others, without discrimination of any kind. Because the most dangerous individuals, alas, are not in mental asylums and prisons, but are out there, ready to catechize and evangelize, scientifically of course, that legion of humans who do not know their bodies or their minds very well. Even though these new earthly priests know very well, thanks to what kind of catechizers and evangelizers the people of the earth, except for those of some tribes, do not know their bodies or their minds, nor do they have the slightest idea of how their conscience could develop naturally. But let's go with my condensed curriculum vitae. My home street and my childhood friends are the survivors. They can testify that the Ponsprud's brothers were happy children, with no other problems, and neither as children, nor as adolescents, nor as adults say than those derived from the humble condition of our parents and as worker fighters with libertarian ideas. Today I will only talk about myself. From a very young age I slept well, and from time to time I had wonderful dreams that almost always took place in the middle of nature. This was because my parents took us to the countryside almost every Sunday in autumn, winter and spring, near Tinwaylaconreeril and in summer to Mongat Beach. My mother made me explain my dreams to her from time to time. I never had the slightest nightmare, because my parents were not the kind who threatened their children with the Iba Jimena or Ao Pedro Botero or TMS Boilerser or other nonsense of that kind. Nonsense that gave many boys and girls complexes for the rest of their lives. I know of several cases, even in my own street. The first teachers I had were Monsieur and Madame Gabarou, who had their academy on Col del Carmen, very close to the Rambla de las Flores. They had lived in Barcelona since 1914. They were such good people that the outbreak of the First World War must have horrified them. And since Monsieur Gabarou was a person incapable of killing a fly and a great lover of life, He preferred to go into exile in Catalonia and teach the boys and girls entrusted to him to be good people. Then, in 1918, at the end of that new massacre, as the great Anatole France said after the first confrontation between Germans and French, in 1870, it was clear that the youth of both countries had gone to war to defend everything except their homeland. That is undoubtedly why I never heard any of my teachers talk about it, about a local homeland, nor about my parents, of course. We were taught A and we learned A that our homeland was the world and our family was humanity. It was that simple. The kindness of that French couple left its mark on me forever. That is why I always had beautiful dreams and never a single nightmare. Until our civil war broke out in 1936. Then I stopped dreaming, but without having nightmares of any kind, even though the situation was rather conducive to them. I stopped sleeping unsteadily. So much so that, already in 1937, many mornings, when I woke up, my mother would ask me, "Ayo, didn't you hear the bombing last night? A later A," and with this I gave rise to all kinds of jokes. A in the Battle of the Ebro, hidden deep in the shelter, I slept soundly while the enemy, with their artillery and their aircraft, literally destroyed our positions. Do you remember, comrades, the special machine gun battalion of the V Corps, when we defended Hill 424, on the crest of the Valle de Latua, lost during the day several times and recovered at night as many times? Because it turns out that the Republicans, with our artillery and air cover so meager, were forced to operate in the dark. And the only thing I remember dreaming about A since my baptism of fire in the Sierra del Guadarrama, in the autumn of 1937 A was my bed in Barcelona, A its clean sheets and warm blankets. We could say, at most, that they were dreams slightly tinged with nostalgia. 10. In 1939 A until 1944 A, during my French exile, including my second war, the French campaign, 1939-1940, which I fought on the borders of France, Luxembourg and Belgium, I continued to sleep like a log. Without dreams or nightmares, despite having the Nazis within range. I slept 8, 9 and even 10 hours a night. A regimen of rest that I would continue to practice, after losing my second war as well, later, as a peasant, and also later, in 1942-1944, when I had to serve as a guerrilla in the south of France. I spent the years 1944-1948 virtually in Spain, living and acting in complete clandestinity. The family whose home I rented for nearly 2 years still lives at number 26 Vuelta del Ruiz 8 Hilda plus minus or, in Valencia. There I neither dreamed nor had nightmares, and it was just as well, because the lady, the housewife, was the widow of a captain fallen by God in Spain, addicted to the Franco regime, of course, so that if I had taken to daydreaming, for example, or having nightmares, the good lady would have wasted no time in going to report me to the police. I went into exile again, walking the Pyrenees alone, in the spring of 1948. And I continued sleeping normally. Well, what I understand by normal since July 1936, since I would have liked to return to my wonderful childhood dreams. Now, fresh in my 60s, yes, I am from the fifth of the bottle, but I enlisted voluntarily before being called up. I continue sleeping my 7 or 8 hours and my partner can attest that I do not have any nightmares and I can assure you that I continue not dreaming. As for conscience A and the great importance that children's education has in shaping it are three-quarters of the same thing has happened to me. Neither in the Guadarrama, autumn-winter of 1937, nor in the Segre, spring of 1938, nor in the Ebro, summer-autumn of 1938, it ever occurred to me to insult, and even less mistreat, any prisoner of war. Not even the Italians, are some of them quite cockier, that I had to lead to the Falset football field one day in August of 1938. And in France, in the guerrilla, just as in Spain, my only obsession was always to harmonize the effectiveness of the actions with the safeguarding of my men.